Across the Pacific, 5,000 miles, all cities in Japan will be blacked out tonight. Meantime, one of the administration's most violent critics, Charles A. Lindbergh, has made a statement. Here it is. We have been stepping closer to war for many months. Now it has come and we must meet it as united Americans, regardless of our attitude in the past toward the policy of our government and what it has followed. And the America First Committee itself says that it will hold no more meetings in New York City until further notice. Ladies and gentlemen, the NBC Newsroom will be on the air with the latest war news at the beginning of every program, day and night. In addition, all programs will be interrupted to bring you the important bulletins as they are received. Keep tuned to this station, for NBC is now operating 24 hours a day. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Well, hello there, everybody. For the young in age and the young in heart, we present Laurie York Erskine with another adventure story. Famous author of books for boys and creator of Renfrew of the Mounted, Mr. Erskine brings you each weekday afternoon at this same hour a new and thrilling tale of pioneering and adventure. And here he is right now, Laurie York Erskine.
Thank you, Lyle, and good evening, friends. Next Monday is the birthday of the Bill of Rights, and today our whole spirit as a nation is concentrated upon the significance of those basic liberties embodied in the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. That code of human dignities derives much of its strength and vitality, I think, from the fact that our ancestors wrote it down not out of dreams and visions, but out of bitter indignities which they had actually suffered. Today, I'm going to tell you the absolutely true story of how an American citizen went to town in the year 1777 to carry supplies to his family. And while I tell it, perhaps you can count the number of times he suffered an abuse of those rights and liberties which he and his fellow citizens incorporated later in that Bill of Rights. Young Israel Israels was the son of an English colonist who had settled at Newcastle, Delaware. In his middle 20s, young Israel married Hannah Irwin, a childhood sweetheart, and they settled on a small farm on the banks of the Delaware River, about 20 miles below Philadelphia. That was in the year 1776, and of course, young Israel soon found that he had to decide whether he was going to be a Tory and stand with the king, or join up with the colonists who were fighting for independence. He decided that he was on the side of freedom, and he felt so hotly about it that he would have joined up. But his younger brother, Joseph, persuaded him to draw lots for the honor, and Joseph won. So Israel stayed home on the farm. As George Washington fought what seemed to be a losing battle down the length of New Jersey and was beaten into winter quarters at Valley Forge, a queer and lamentable change took place among young Israel's neighbors. Many of them became Tories and sold food to the British troops in Philadelphia, so that none of Israel's neighbors would do business with him, and he was cut off from the city of Philadelphia as a rebel. This was bad, because Israel's mother and sister were now living in Philadelphia, and he learned that since the Tories and the British soldiery were commandeering all the supplies in the town, his mother and sister were in actual danger of starvation. So he decided to go to Philadelphia and help them, whatever the cost might be. One of his neighbors, who had been sending in supplies to the British troops, pretended to sympathize with him and gave him the password, which would let him through the line. So, one day toward the end of December, you might have seen the big, powerful figure of this young farmer plodding up the river road toward the city, covered by a cloak, which made him seem immensely stout, since it covered large bundles of provisions, which he hoped to get through the picket. It was dark when he reached the outpost and was hailed by the British sentinel with, "Who goes there?" "A friend," he replied, and wondered if the soldier could hear the beating of his heart. "Advance and give the countersign," said the sentry. Israel gave the countersign in a voice that he forced to sound steady, and he almost gasped with relief when the sentinel passed him on. He arrived at his mother's house and was greeted with as much alarm as affection. His young sister almost dragged him in through the door and didn't utter a word until she closed it. Then she said in a whisper, "Your brother Joseph's here. He's in uniform." Israel hugged his sister and kissed her. Then he dashed upstairs, where his young brother sat talking with his mother in his battle-stained continental uniform. But his mother was frantic with anxiety. "You can't stay here," she said. "Both of you, you've got to go. There's a Hessian sergeant billeted at this house, and he may return at any minute." Even as she spoke, there was a patter of hoofs on the cobbles down the street, and the sound of boisterous German voices. "They're coming back," cried the mother. She seized Joseph in her arms. "You must hide," she cried. "You must go. They mustn't find you here." "Leave it to me, mother," said Israel, and he hustled her from the room. Quickly, he hauled from a closet some of Joseph's old clothes and made the boy change into them. Then, covering Joseph with his coat, he hustled him up a ladder to the roof. He gave Joseph the password and told him to hurry out of Philadelphia as fast as he could. Fortunately, the Hessian soldiers had carried down the street, putting their horses away. And by the time the sergeant came bursting into the house, Joseph was well on his way. The mother and sister greeted the sergeant in the hall. "There is he," bellowed the sergeant. "The rebel. There's a rebel in this house." "I don't know what you mean," said the mother. "There is a rebel soldier here. They told me," yelled the sergeant. He saw Israel coming down the stairs. "Ah, there he is," he cried. And pulling out a pistol, he shoved it into Israel's side. "Surrender, you rebel," he shouted. "I don't know what you're talking about," said Israel. "I'm this lady's son. No more a rebel than you are." But the Hessian marched him upstairs and into the room where Joseph's uniform was lying on the bed. "There, his soul," cried the Hessian. "Caesar told me you were here, and in uniform." Caesar was Mrs. Israel's chore boy, and Israel called him in. "Dare you," he cried, fixing the boy with a terrible look. "Dare you, Caesar, call me a rebel?" The boy hung his head and muttered, "No." "You see," said Israel, "you're mistaken." He picked up the uniform and held it against his huge frame. Designed for the slighter body of Joseph, it was obviously, even ridiculously, too small for him. "My brother Joseph must be the person you want," he said. "The foolish boy is breaking our hearts by running with the rebels." Reluctantly, the sergeant agreed that he'd been mistaken. He turned instantly on Mrs. Israel. "What are you doing here?" he cried. "Where is my dinner?" And Israel almost forgot the part he was playing when he saw the Hessian push his mother from the room. Then followed an almost unendurable ordeal. Israel had to sit at the table with his mother and sister and repress his almost uncontrollable resentment while the rude Hessian poured out a coarse and brutal contempt for Joseph and all rebels, while he boasted in detail of his exploits in slaughtering the colonists. Israel had to keep his clenched hands beneath the table while the agonized and entreating looks of his mother and sister held his rising anger in check. "I was at Paoli," boasted the sergeant. "We came down on the rebels at night. We used only our bayonets so that no noise was made. Ah, how they ran, without clothes, without guns, in the light of their own fires. They cried out that they surrendered, but we laughed at them. We struck them with our bayonets like they were pigs, till the blood ran out of the touch holes of our muskets." This was too much for Israel. Snatching up his knife, he jumped to his feet with murder in his eyes. But in the same instant, his sister rose in her place, gave him one look of entreaty, and fell in a faint to the floor. This threw the terrible dinner party into complete confusion, and the stupid sergeant, flustered and embarrassed by this exhibition of women's weaknesses, left the house and repaired to the tavern. Israel's sister, thereupon, immediately came out of her faint. But knowing that if her son was found in Philadelphia, he would have to stand trial as a spy, Mrs. Israel insisted that he'd get back before the night was over. So, giving his mother and sister what comfort he could, Israel made his way down the river and breathed with relief again as he passed the British sentinel. But the neighbor who had given him the password not only sold cattle to the British, but he sold information as well, and he made a few dishonorable dollars by informing the river patrol that Israel was a rebel spy who was now on his way back from a venture inside the British lines. So no sooner had Israel arrived on his farm than he and his wife's brother were arrested and carried on board a British frigate lying in the Delaware River directly opposite his farm. And there they were informed that they would be tried as spies. For several days, the commander of the British ship caused all Israel's Tory neighbors to come on board and testify against him. And they came forward with every story they could remember hearing which suggested that Israel might be a spy. At last, one of them told the British commander that Israel had said in his hearing that he would sooner drive his cattle as a present to General Washington than to receive thousands of dollars in British gold for them. This roused the French commander's anger and had Israel brought on deck before him. "I understand," he said, "that you would not sell your cattle for British gold." He pointed across to where Israel's cattle grazed in a large pasture that came down to the river on the Delaware shore. "Those, I believe, are your cattle," he said. Israel nodded. "Then it will be a good lesson for you," said the British officer, "to see how the king can take what cattle the rebels refuse to sell him. You may stand here and watch." He then gave orders to a lieutenant of the Marines to take a squad of men on shore and shoot every one of the cattle in the meadow. Israel stood on deck and watched with a sinking heart while the small boat took the uniformed Marines to the shore of his meadow with their muskets glittering in the sunlight. His fear wasn't for his cattle, but for his young wife, a girl only 19 years old, who, with a little chore boy, waited in the farmhouse on the hill above for word of whether her husband and her brother would ever return to her or not. He saw the boat land and the Marines get out on the beach. But Hannah Israel had seen them, too. Israel saw her run down from the house, the little chore boy beside her. As the Marines ran their boat on the beach, she was taking down the bars of the meadow fence. "Run," she cried to the chore boy. "Come on, head them off." And swiftly she ran down the meadow between the Marines and the cattle, herding them at a run for the pasture gate. "Stop, stand back," cried the officer. "Stand away from those cows or I'll fire." "Fire away," cried the girl. And with her back toward them, she herded the cattle up the pasture. To Israel's horror, he saw the Marines take aim and fire. He saw the bullets kick up the turf as they landed all about her. But brave Hannah didn't even notice them. Running this way and that, she herded the frightened cattle at a run for the pasture gate, shouting encouragement to the boy. "Head them off, Joe," she cried. "Over there, up the field. Head them into the gate. Don't let one of them escape." And not one of them did escape. The Marines reloaded and fired again and again. The bullets whistled around her and spattered on the ground. Short of the pasture gate, the little chore boy tumbled to the ground. Hannah dashed to his side. Tucking him under one arm, she pulled him up along with her, crowded the last few cattle through the gate, lifted the small boy over, and then, putting up the bars, she stood there, her arms outstretched along the top rail, facing the marauders. They could have those cattle only over her dead body, the gesture said, and they knew it. Sheepishly, the Marines returned to their boat and set back for the frigate. Israel, all his fear lost in pride and sheer worship of the girl he loved, turned and found the English commander standing very thoughtfully beside him. "I think," said the British officer, "it's time we had a hearing of your case." So a hearing was held on the quarterdeck. Again, the Tory witnesses gave their contemptible testimony. Israel calmly and without evasion related his secret visit to Philadelphia to carry relief to his mother and sister. He also admitted frankly that he would rather give up his cattle to Washington than sell them for British gold. To all of which, the British commander listened attentively. Then, the British officer, who it appears had done considerable thinking since he had seen the behavior of Israel's young wife, proceeded to tell the Tory neighbors precisely what an honorable man must think of them. He reprimanded them for their cowardly and contemptible conduct in betraying and bringing false charges against a good man. He acquitted Israel of all blame and acknowledged his right to bear what political opinion he believed in, so long as he didn't take up arms against the king. Then he sent Israel and his brother-in-law back to shore in his own barge with an escort of honor, and he sent with them a present of gold pins and brocaded silks as a token of his admiration and esteem for Israel's heroic wife. In this manner, our American gentleman returned home after delivering his groceries to his family in Philadelphia.
Been listening to Laurie York Erskine, noted author, telling another of his colorful stories that open up new and exciting worlds for all whose hearts are young. Mr. Erskine will return at the same hour tomorrow with another story of adventure. This is the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.
Mm-hmm.